Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Evolved Caveman. And today on the Evolved Caveman, we have a sobering yet incredibly important topic, that of suicide. And this conversation may be triggering for some listeners. So if you are actively considering suicide, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. And I'm pleased to share with you my guest today, Dr. Thomas Joyner. With his appearance on the Evolved Caveman today, Thomas has become the first human ever to appear both on my radio show back in 2006 and my podcast, so I am really pleased to talk with him today. Dr. Joyner is the author of Lonely at the Top, The High Cost of Men's Success, and Why People Die by Suicide. He has spent much of his career trying to find out why people die from suicide. The desire for death, according to Thomas, is comprised of two psychological states. One, a perception of being a burden to others. The other is a feeling of not belonging, not feeling connected to family or other relationships. And alone, neither one of these states is enough to instill the desire for death. But together with what Dr. Joyner has labeled an acquired capacity for suicide or a fearlessness of death, the risk for suicide is increased. So today, an important talk on depression and suicidality, particularly in light of a recent CDC report that came out August 14th of 2020 on the increase in mental health challenges due to COVID. A conversation about the best ways to help men avoid lives of quiet desperation, feeling less than, isolation from others, and addiction through positive changes individually in our culture and support services. So if you're a man living with these challenges or worried about a man in your life, you have to listen to this conversation. So, Thomas, let's begin by talking about some of the statistics from the CDC report. And by the way, welcome and thank you for coming aboard. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be with you.
So the CDC report just came out last week stating that 40% of U.S. adults are struggling with mental health or substance use issues during the week of June 24th to 30th of this year. So they looked at 5,400 people, 31% of respondents reported experiencing symptoms of anxiety or depression, 13.3% reported increasing or beginning substance use to deal with stress or emotions related to COVID, and 1 in 10 respondents reported having seriously considered suicide in the past 30 days. So can you speak to some of those statistics a little bit?
Well, certainly on their surface, they're concerning. And they're pretty consistent with some other work that I'm aware of. For instance, there's a psychologist at San Diego State with whom I collaborate fairly often. Her name is Jean Twenge, and Jean and I have a paper right now in press. It's at a journal called Depression and Anxiety, showing exactly the same thing that the CDC report showed. It's concerning with regard to things like depression, anxiety, even suicidal ideation, with regard to those translating over into risk for actual suicidal behavior, including suicide death, that's not necessarily going to be the case. It might be, because those things are clearly risks for suicidal behavior and suicide death, but what the report really focused on was not on the behavior or the death, but the emotions and the ideation piece. Let's hope that there's not much of a translation over into behavior. Maybe there are some aspects of this pandemic and of this moment that, while certainly stressful, for sure, maybe there are some other elements that are countervailing and that buffer people from risk. In fact, there's some evidence starting to emerge of that very effect. Not overall, because the CDC findings and the findings that Gene and I produced were about general population, American population kinds of level. And on that level, clearly there's an increase in risk. But some certain subpopulations may be protected, which is kind of an interesting thing that we can drill down into a little bit more if you'd like to.
Yeah, what are some of these protective factors?
Well, there's one paper that I'm aware of that's made a pretty convincing case that this increase in things like depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation is not affecting small town America very much. And so maybe small town life is a buffer. That's been one hypothesis offered. Turns out that most of America is not living in small towns these days. It depends on how you measure it, but about 3 out of 4 people are living in pretty urban or suburban areas, and most are not in small towns. And but those who are may be protected. Somewhat similarly, we found in 2 other populations, the FSU undergrads. I'm a professor at Florida State University, and we study our psychology undergrads on an ongoing basis. And so we had a take on them pre-COVID and now post-COVID. And they're actually doing pretty well, somewhat surprisingly well. Same with our psychotherapy outpatients. We run a clinic here in Tallahassee, and we figured, you know, that group, many of them have approached us and engaged us because of their suicidality. We thought that maybe they would have quite a bad time, especially having to transition over to telehealth. On the contrary, we've observed a decrease in their risk. And I think in all those examples, the small town folks are connected to one another. The FSU undergraduates have remained connected to us and to their classes, and FSU psychotherapy outpatients have remained connected to their therapists through telehealth.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if you're Harvard just came out with a research, Jordan Smaller, looking at what helps us avoid depression. They looked at 106 changeable behaviors, and the one or two that came up as prominent protective factors is the frequency of confiding in others and also visits with friends and family, which that seems to lend itself, at least the second one, to living in small town, which I would think would have more cohesive social connection.
I think so. I think those are vital. I think just the way we're wired from, you know, eons and eons ago, our basic wiring is constructed such that we need one another. You know, we're just socially constructed creatures, and you take away that basic social input, you're flirting with disaster there. And so it doesn't surprise me that those kinds of experiences rose to the top. And I'm noticing that as people are starting to very carefully, very gradually reemerge and reengage, at least in some pockets of the country, people are just finding how much they missed even just casual, brief, real social interactions. Yeah. It makes sense though, because that's how this, you know, very complicated neural equipment that we're endowed with, that's how it was constructed, based on those inputs, those social inputs.
Yeah, and the other thing that's interesting in what you were talking about earlier is that I know several people that are pretty severely depressed with some social anxiety, and I've been surprised that during COVID, they've been, for the most part, quite good emotionally. And it's one I was even joking with, saying, you know, wow, this is right in your wheelhouse. We should start an online course to teach people how to thrive within COVID, because he's happy as a clam in his room on his computer and with very little social interaction.
Right.
So something fly in the face of the data.
Right. Right. There are bound to be exceptions like that for sure. People who just feel more at home, you know, you're just more comfortable, more at home, more like they belong in virtual environments. It's certainly not the majority, but there's definitely a group, and they're going to, you know, seem a little bit different. And then there's a group who are very extroverted, very social people, and they're going to feel it being removed from others. Then there's a group who is shy and introverted. And that's the surprising group, because that group you might have expected will really kind of like your friend or the person you're talking about, you might have expected that group to thrive under these conditions. And yet what a lot of them are finding is that though they were introverted and shy, they still had personal, you know, albeit brief conversations with a coworker or just somebody walking down the street. And they find how much they miss that. And when they're venturing out a little bit these days, carefully, safely, they're finding real gratification just from, you know, some very, very brief contact with people.
Yeah, the people that I've seen struggle the most with this situation are people that are extroverted and living home alone. So those needs to socialize are just truncated. They're just chopped off.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense that they have those needs and have them all along and really have thrived on that. And then all of a sudden, all that was just taken away. And if they're alone at home, it's really taken away. That group has had a hard time of it. That group also tends to have sort of protections built in. On average, the more extroverted among us have built up resources, psychological resources, that maybe can be used to weather the storm a little bit. But still, it's going to be hard on them.
Let me ask you another question. I mean, you know, there's a couple things that have stuck with me from our conversation almost 15 years ago, that perception of being a burden to others, and the other part, which was a feeling of not belonging. That feeling of a burden I've seen a lot in my depressed clients that have had pretty high suicidal ideation. Tell me more about your theory on that.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's a classic theory that harkens back to really Greek philosophy. And all throughout the centuries, people have in one way or another reflected on and ruminated what basically drives us, what at the bottom line is important to us in terms of our values. People like Durkheim and Freud wrestled with these ideas 150 years ago. And a lot of the answers across the centuries have come down to basically it's love and work, depending on how you put that. Love in the sense of you feel cared for and you have people that you care about. And work in the sense that you feel there's meaning and purpose and contribution to be made. And that makes a lot of sense, intuitive sense, that those are main drivers of just who we are and what we value. And that's where the theory is coming from, is that when those two things are really cut off somehow and people are made to feel the opposite of those things, namely like they don't belong and like, you know, not only do they not contribute, but they actively bring others down and feel like a burden on others. When people feel that way, it's a painful combination. And not only that, We've accrued a fair amount of data now to support the idea that those are main features of the suicidal mindset.
Well, and explain the third piece of this learned capacity to fear death less.
Yeah, the word learned was something that I definitely was a proponent of 15 years ago. In fact, in the main book I wrote about this, I used the word acquired capacity, but learned is also a word that I used a lot. And I still think that's apt, but I've just become impressed over the last 15 years about how important genetics are in that particular quality. It's not totally genetic, not really by a long shot, but it's more genetic than I understood 15 years ago, put it that way. But anyway, this capacity, it's really a novel concept in some ways, but actually I think it's a very obvious concept in a lot of other ways. And the novel part of it is that people just hadn't really focused much on the difference between somebody just thinking about suicide or talking about it, things like that, versus somebody who takes the step of actually doing that incredibly fearsome and daunting thing. And that transition is what I focused on and came up with the answer that to do something like that, not just talk about it in the abstract, but actually face it, stare down death. It's really very difficult to do. And only people who have a particular quality can manage it. Most people just can't manage it. Even people who desperately want to die, they can't manage it because it's too fearsome. It's too against our natures. But some people do manage it. And my answer to who they are people who've developed an unusual amount of fearlessness, specifically fearlessness about injury, pain, and death itself. And then that also there's more to that capacity idea than just the fearlessness piece. That's key. But another key piece of it has to do with just familiarity, comfort, you might say, and knowledge with the means of suicide that somebody's thinking about. And for instance, you got two people who are at risk for suicide. One of them, well, let's say both of them have a loaded weapon in the residence, but one of them has no idea how to fire a weapon, never done it before. The other has a lot of familiarity with it. It is quite the gun enthusiast. Well, obviously that latter person who knows how to use it is going to be more at risk than the person who has no idea how to use it, even though otherwise they're both similarly at risk. So that you might call that practical capability. So when people have practical capability and when they have the fearlessness and the fearlessness of death, fearlessness of pain, when they have all that, that just by itself can be actually a useful quality. A lot of firefighters, law enforcement officers, active duty service members, they have exactly that quality. So it can be very admirable and to the public good. The trouble is when that quality gets combined with a deep feeling that you're a burden, others would be better off without you, you don't belong, you don't fit in. When those all come together, that's when you see these catastrophes.
And so you work in the clinic with, I'm assuming, depressives and or people with suicidal ideation, correct?
That's right.
How concerned do you get when someone comes to you with suicidal thoughts, but not much else? No plan, no willingness to take action?
Not very concerned. I mean, my concern level is not zero. I mean, you know, most people are not talking about thinking about suicide at all or death or anything like that. That's what you want to see, obviously. And then some are talking about it. But that by itself is just not very concerning. You know, you have to be on your toes about it, vigilant about it, keep your eye out for any further escalation and risk. But that alone strikes me just by itself, without any other further escalation parameters, it strikes me as just the depression talking. Mm-hmm. It's a symptom of a mood disorder. And so my idea is to treat that mood disorder, and then all that will go away, including the suicidal talk. But then there are other presentations where it's more than just talk. There's a lot of other worrying factors. And so there my attention is much more fixed on the suicide risk than it is on, well, really anything else until that risk is lowered to a manageable degree.
So to what extent do you think, I mean, one of the conclusions I've come to over, you know, 20, 25 years in this field is that the mind at sometimes or much of the time is just a random thought generating machine, and we can't necessarily stop certain thoughts from coming. We can change how we react to those thoughts. To what extent do you think a thought like, I want to end the pain, I want to take my own life, is somewhat or relatively normal? In other words, that most people in life have had that thought at one point or another when things just get painful.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that perspective. I mean, there are a lot of people. I would actually wager that it's the majority who really don't resonate with that thought at all in any fashion. And I think that's a common thing. But I think, like you're saying, also a pretty common thing for the thought to be fleeting or just to be considered or things of that nature. And I think those are all – on a, you know, in general terms, they're all kind of at the low end of the spectrum, non-worrisome end of the spectrum. And then there are other presentations where people are doing much more than that. And that's when you get a little more concerned.
Yeah. And I don't want to minimize it, but I think that in our minds, a lot of times we'll have a thought and then we have an emotional reaction to the thought, like, oh my God, I shouldn't think like that. And then you feel guilty and then you feel sad and then you feel angry at yourself and you get in this negative thought emotion spiral. And so I think for people on the lesser end of that spectrum where there's low suicidality, and just the thought of life sucks right now, I want to take my own life, to normalize that thought can be helpful at times.
I think so too, in the sense that thoughts are so trivial. I mean, they're just, you know, you said a moment ago, like random. And in addition to that, they're also just so trivial and so unimportant. What does it matter what one individual out of 7 billion thinks on a Tuesday afternoon at 3 and that? I mean, it's just so trivial. And one line that I'm proud of in the book I wrote on mindfulness compares that kind of thing to treasuring. Like if one were to treasure one's thoughts and treat them as so important, thought after thought after thought, you may as well treasure your own sweat. It's the same thing. It's like these thoughts are like mental sweat, and there's nothing to treasure about them. You just brush them away and move on, usually. So, well, yeah, there's something to that. There's a usefulness to that kind of approach to things, I think.
And I think you have to be careful in terms of who you do that with. But the majority of people that I talk to that come up with suicidal thoughts are at the low end of the suicidal scale. Like they're very low risk to actually act on those thoughts. And so I think to take some of the sting and power out of thoughts like that, because I've had a thought like that in the past, like, and it's been, you know, a long time, but I've thought, you know, geez, life sucks so much right now. It would be easier to just end my life. Now I wasn't going to act on that. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I said a minute ago, we've both been saying, like, thoughts can they're just sometimes random, sometimes so trivial. And I think that that's right. And then for somebody to sentence themselves to death on the basis of something like that, some thought, it's just, it doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah. You have mental.
Mental sweat. Yeah. You went out there for a second, but yeah, I mean, you may as well. Yeah, that's as good a basis to sentence yourself to death as some random thought. Now, but you're right that it is important not to trivialize these thoughts or not to, you know, not take them seriously, because they can be very serious and they can be lethal too. So right. that's worth repeating as well.
Right. Yeah. And I want to make sure that we don't trivialize them. Let's go a little bit into the man culture and talk about how that figures into this. Because I think, you know, your book, Lonely at the Top, The High Cost of Men's Success, dovetails pretty nicely with that. So I talk a lot about the man box culture on this show and the rules that we internalize as boys and how they affect us as men. And some of the rules are things like, you know, we suffer pain in silence. We don't ask for help. We don't have any needs. We're not supposed to lose. The big one to me is we're not supposed to feel. So a lot of our emotions come out as anger or irritability. Don't be seen as weak. How do you think that enters into this phenomenon of male depression and male suicidality?
I think it's relevant for sure. My main sort of advice in that book on loneliness is for men to cultivate relationships across the lifespan. Because my concern in that book anyway was people who either were lonely all along and still find themselves lonely at 40, 50, 60, 70, or just as dangerous, people, men mostly, who were not particularly lonely in their younger days because, you know, environments like school, college, if that's relevant, some workplaces, they just kind of serve up naturally without any effort, male friendships. But then those start to deteriorate if you don't take care of them. And that sort of natural, like school-like serving up of friendships goes away. And so people who were pretty connected when they were, say, 20, can find themselves gradually over time very disconnected at, say, 60. And so those two groups, lonely all along, and then the ones who became lonely because they didn't nurture their friendships over time, that group's dangerous. And they're mostly men, and they can be they're very overrepresented in suicide decedents. And so, yeah, that's the main thing that I was on, you know, focusing on in that book is just relationship maintenance. And I didn't treat much the role of masculinity and the expectations of masculinity in there, but I can see that they would be definitely relevant to that.
So my experience has been with men that there seems to be two groups as we move throughout the lifespan. One that seems to be pretty good about maintaining friendships over the years, and one that they just kind of gradually slough off. And, you know, even for me individually, I realized that I lost a lot of my male friendships when I got divorced, which I was kind of surprised about, and then had to work hard to recreate new friendships. What's been your experience personally with friendships throughout the years?
Well, it's been very good, but only because I, for whatever reason, early on, well, I can put my finger on one reason that this happened, which I'll get back to in a second. But from an early age, I understood this truth that these friendships, you know, that I have when I'm 15, 20, 25, these are special and they need to be treated like that. They need to be nurtured and maintained. And so I did it. I was very active in that, and then was, you know, okay at making new friends. Not great, I would say, but making new friends into my 30s and 40s. The reason I want to loop back around and say that I probably understood it from an early age is that I saw this happening to my own dad, who, you know, when, you know, I can remember him as in the very first years of my life, he was in his 30s, pretty gregarious and connected. And then I just saw that deteriorate into his 50s. And I thought it was because he, you know, in large part just did not do the work of maintaining these friendships. And it ended disastrously. He killed himself when he was 56. So obviously that made a huge impression on me. And so for that reason, but for others too, I've been pretty careful about friendship maintenance over the course of decades.
Yeah. And I think the reason this is important to bring up is for any men that are out there listening, please value your friendships, your male friendships, like gold, and continue to reach out throughout the lifespan. I know I got distracted when I was in the trenches, parenting four children and working, and I just let my college friends go. And then I had to kind of go back to them later and reach out again. But in talking about this with men, it seems universally there's this fear of, well, they're going to be mad at me if I reach out and, you know, I haven't talked to them in 5 or 10 years. And almost universally, the response is, hey, great to hear from you. How you been?
Absolutely. Yeah. Not only that, but it's almost as if you never, like, it just comes back naturally. It's, you know, maybe, on occasion somebody will be kind of upset about that, but that's temporary. You get through that and then, you know, get back to friendship. But yeah, my main experience of it has been, I'm a big fan of going back to reunions, like high school reunions, college reunions. So I've seen a lot of instances where I have just lost touch with someone, haven't seen them in a couple instances, like for 25 years. And you would think that's just too big a gulf to just pick things right back up where they were back in, you know, the 1980s or whatever. But we did. We just didn't miss a beat. It was really remarkable and very, very rewarding too.
So let me ask you a difficult question. And I don't know if you have an answer to this, but one of the things I've been struggling with lately is ways to get lonely clients connected in new friendships right now in COVID?
Right. Well, even without COVID, it's a pretty big challenge. So for big challenges, I'm just a real fan of chipping away. Small, very small chip, just keep chipping away over the course of days, weeks, months, trusting that if you'll be committed to chipping away every day, at least a little bit, you know, you wake up 6 months from now, a year from now, and things are different. And the way that I advise people to chip away at loneliness is just simply showing up. There's various forms of socially being present. You know, even if you don't know anybody, even if you're not going to talk to anybody, it doesn't matter. As long as you at least be present and give the opportunity a chance to happen where you connect, make an acquaintance, you know, have a pleasant few words, I don't know, share a talk or an art exhibit or whatever the case may be that where people are congregating. Just, you know, it's human nature to just be part of those congregations. And if you cut yourself off from that, you're just limiting the chance to benefit from that and also to meet new acquaintances. So that's my bargain with patients who are dealing with loneliness is your part of the deal is showing up. And that's it. You don't even have to talk to anybody. Just show up. It would be better if you talk to somebody. It'd be better if you talk to a lot of people, but that's not the bargain. The bargain is to show up in the first place. But what happens if people will commit to that over the course of months is that, of course, they start talking to people and start chatting with people, make acquaintances and so forth.
Yeah, I think, you know, some of the suggestions I've made in the past would be things like, you know, volunteer organizations, Lions Club, Rotary, depending on age, meetup groups, you know, go for a hike with a meetup group.
Exactly.
And reach out to old friends, but that's a problem if, you know, you were talking about that group of kind of lonely people for a life across a lifespan. That's, you know, if someone says, well, I didn't have any friends in high school, then that kind of shuts that down. But I also think part of it is adopting a growth mindset a la Carol Dweck of, I can make these changes. I can learn how to be more social. I'm not the shy person I think I am. I can learn new ways of being and socializing.
Right. And I mean, and I think even for people who are shy, they can stay shy and still make friends. Shy people have a lot of friends. Some of them do. It's just, you know, finding some range within your set points. And for some people, you know, they do have a true set point of shyness, and someone else has a true kind of set point of, you know, being very outgoing, but there's a big range around those set points, and people can wander, so to speak, throughout that range. And so that's the way I think about it is that, you know, even if it's true that you're inherently or temperamentally pretty shy, that doesn't really necessarily mean anything in terms of showing up. You can still show up. Shy people do it all the time.
Are you familiar with Todd Kasdan?
Yeah, sure.
So he wrote the book Curiosity, and there's great stuff in that book. But one of the things that I will often suggest to my shy clients is, okay, keep being shy, and also add to that the story that you are an intensely curious person, and you just want to get to know other people's stories. So there's no other, like, if you're a guy, like, I have guys that get hung up, young guys that get hung up on, like, meeting a girl or getting a phone number or things like that. And it's like, forget all that. Lower your expectations. Tell yourself you're just curious. You just want to get to know her story. Nothing else. But if you can continually tell yourself that you're curious about other people, I think that can motivate you to reach out and initiate at times.
It sounds like a great approach to me. I mean, it sounds effective. And then the other benefit that I can see of that is that it pulls people out of their own minds, you know, their own self-absorption. You know, if you're curious about what's going on with someone else, curious about what their story is, you don't have as much time to dwell over, you know, your own sort of self preoccupations. So I see that makes a lot of sense to me, and I see multiple benefits in it.
Yeah. With anxiety and depression, we've always got that spotlight of attention shining on ourselves. And I'm always telling clients, like, if you can turn that spotlight around and focus on others, it gets you out of your head and you're going to be way better off.
Yeah, no doubt.
So let me ask you one other question. So one of the the stories, I guess I've made up in my mind is that, and this kind of goes back to the man box culture where the value, I'm often looking at values. And I think the value that we men start off with to support the family, to be the provider for the family is in general a very healthy value. And yet what happens, it seems to me, with a lot of the executives that I see by the age of 50, give or take, is that that very value that we started off with that was healthy gets morphed and cancerous over the course of 10, 20, 30 years. And now we've lost sight of the very reason that we're doing the work for. And I think that many of us get wrapped up in ego, chances for advancement, making more money, power. I don't know. I think there's a variety of reasons, but we begin to spend more and more time and energy and effort at work and less time and attention at home, which was originally the reason why we set out to do this. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the idea that, you know, there's been a lot of attention lately. I think the American Psychological Association put something out last year, maybe it was 2 years ago, about masculinity. I didn't have anything to do with it. And I didn't really even like worry over it too much, but I was aware of it because it was discussed a lot. And there are a lot of similar efforts like that. And they're definitely well-meaning, but my view of them is they go a little too far about, you know, how men should not be this and they should not be that. I think it's actually a pretty, you know, expectable and can be a healthy thing about masculinity and to want to do some of the things that are stereotypically masculine to a degree, you know, within moderation. And so that's the point that I really resonate to that is also, I think, in some of those kind of work efforts like the American Psychological Association's is that moderation idea. And so, you know, taking care of your family, a lot of people take a lot of pride in that. That's not necessarily by any means limited to one sex or the other. But, you know, I'll speak for myself. I take a lot of pride in that. But it can be overdone. And if it gets out of control, it can become toxic. And so that moderation aspect, that's a useful, you know, sort of reminder in a lot of domains, including this one, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of how I talk about it is because I don't have any problem with masculinity in general. I do think there's some of the traits that many of us men can go too far on, like self-reliance, for example. And, you know, my best friend's dad used to pull his teeth out in the garage when they were rotting because he just didn't want to go to the dentist. Well, you could argue that's self-reliance, but it's a little bit destructive. It's not healthy. Right. And so I think it's, you know, where in the middle of those traits do I want to be? And I think the other part of it, so moderation's a good one. I also think that having the ability to shift gears is really critical based upon the context. So, you know, I think that if you're going to go out and play football or rugby, cool, be stereotypically masculine, be a badass, be tough, be dominant, be an alpha. But if you're going to go home and deal with your five-year-old daughter that just skinned her knee, you need the ability to shift gears and be nurturing and caring and quiet and calm. And then if you're going to go out on date night with your wife, you need to be able to be romantic and communicative and loving and listening and supportive. And so to me, it's having that psychological flexibility to know what gear do I need to be in to best fit the context or the situation. And many of the men I talk to only have one gear.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you know, teaching people other gears, you know, that I think would be very helpful. But I think that's true of a lot of domains where if you just got one channel or one note, you know, you're not going to be as effective as if you got, you know, multiple notes that you can hit. And you know, this one seems to fit that pretty well too.
Yeah. So in wrapping up, what should I have asked you that I didn't ask you? Where else would you like to speak to?
Oh, I mean, there's any number of things, but I mean, it's not like there's something that was, you know, urgently on my mind that we overlooked, nothing like that.
Are there any other tips to reduce suicidality either on an individual basis or societal basis?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we've been talking about social connection, and, you know, I think that there's a lot of mileage to be gotten out of that. Even very small amounts of social connection go a long way. You mentioned them a little bit ago as basically antidepressants, and they are. I think they're also pretty strong anti-suicide agents. They're just generally healthy things. But there's some other things like that. Similarly, common sense. You know, I would mention safety around things that could kill you, dangerous things that could kill you. It makes sense to be safe around those things. Things like guns, but not just guns. There are a lot of gun suicides in the U.S. That's true, but only half of the deaths are guns. So it's not everything about guns, but it is important to be safe with guns. It's important to be safe with, potential overdose medications, ligatures, things like that. Mm-hmm. Safe in the sense of just, you know, if you're at risk, if you're feeling these kinds of things about desperation and misery and suicide, well, it makes some sense for you to gain some distance, actual physical distance from something dangerous that you might use to hurt yourself. So that whole line of thought goes under the rubric of means safety, like the means of suicide. Be safe with that. Means safety is the term for that these days. And then just a lot of other very common sense things that people really benefit from. Physical movement, physical activity is important. You know, getting enough sleep to the degree that you can and control it is pretty key. Just the way I think about it is what would you have told a human like 20,000 years ago, 25,000 years ago to be more healthy? Well, our ancestors, what did they do? They got up in the morning. They were pretty active. They were with each other all the time. And they had purpose. They had a real shared purpose. And then they got up and did it again. And they kept doing it. There's a routine to it. When they got up in the morning, they were exposed to morning sunlight every day. They were immersed in nature every day. Well, if we could get back to all those kinds of things, even small doses of those kinds of things, I think that will really speak to our ancient natures.
Yeah, it's interesting you say going back 20,000 years. There was that Harvard study also identified two behaviors that don't help with depression and suicidality: daytime napping and TV watching, which wouldn't have happened 20,000 years ago.
No, that's right. The sleep was just so, dictated really by the elements. Lots of things were dictated by the elements, and all of our technologies have freed us from that a little bit. And that's been that's got benefits to be sure. I mean, medicines, being one example. But there's a dark side to it potentially as well. And so my counsel on that is just to try to benefit from the incredible technologies that we have, but not let their dark side get to you too much. Just because we can doesn't mean we should be inside all day watching TV or sleeping or what have you. It's amazing that we can. Good for our species. We've really come a long way, but we should never do that.
Well, Dr. Joyner, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
And let me read out the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline one more time. It's 1-800-273-8255. Thank you so much. That's it for this episode, The Evolved Caveman.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.